and I didn't think about the consequences. Blue and Mallory both peered at him. It was impossible to tell how long he'd been standing there. "It's very decent of you," he continued, "to not say anything about it to me. It's more than I deserved. I know that I've regretted it a lot."
"Well," said Mallory. He seemed profoundly uncomfortable. The dog looked away. "Well, what is the verdict on your cave woman?"
Gansey put a mint leaf in his mouth. It was impossible to not think of the night before when he'd put one in hers. "She stays here for now. That wasn't me, that was Persephone. I offered to fix the first floor of Monmouth. That might still end up being what happens."
"Who is she?" Blue asked. She tried the name. "Gwendolyn." She wasn't saying it right. The double L's were not said anything like they looked.
"Glendower had 10 children with his wife Margaret, and at least 4 not with her." Gansey said this part with distaste. It was clear that he didn't find this fitting for his hero. "Gwendolyn is one of the 4 illegitimate on record. It's a patriotic name. There were 2 other very famous Gwendolyns who were associated with Welsh freedom." There was something else he wanted to say, but he didn't. It meant it was unpleasant or ugly. Blue said, "Spit it out, Gansey. What is it?" He said, "The way she was buried. The tomb door had Glendower on it, and so did the coffin lid. Not an image of her. We can ask her, though getting real information out of her is quite a thing, but it seems likely to me that she was buried in a shill grave."
"What's that?"
"Sometimes when there's a very rich grave or a very important one, they'll put a duplicate grave somewhere nearby, but easier to find, to give grave robbers something to find."
Blue was scandalized. "His own daughter?"
"Illegitimate," Gansey said, but he was unhappy as he did.
"You heard her. As punishment for something. It is all so distasteful."
"I am starving. Where did Adam and Ronan go?
To get supplies for Gwendolyn."
He looked at his enormous and handsome watch with an enormous and puzzled frown. "Has it been long?" She made a face.
"Ish."
"What do we do now?" Gansey asked. From the other room, Calla bellowed, "Go buy us pizza with extra cheese, Richie Rich." Blue said,
"I think she's starting to like you."
31. Ronan drove back to St. Agnes. Adam thought he meant to go to Adam's apartment above the church office, but when they got out at the street, Ronan veered off and headed to the main entrance of the church itself. Although Adam lived above the church, he had not been inside it since he'd moved into his apartment. The parishes had never been churchgoers, and although Adam himself suspected there might be a god, he also suspected it didn't matter. "Lynch," he said as Ronan opened the door to the dusky sanctuary, "I thought we were going to talk." Ronan dipped his fingers into the holy water and touched his forehead. "It's empty." But the church didn't feel empty. It was claustrophobic with the scent of incense, vases of foreign lilies, reams of white cloth, the broken gaze of a sorrowing Christ. It bled with stories Adam didn't know, rituals he would never do, connections he would never share. It was dense with a humming sort of history that made him feel lightheaded. Ronan hit Adam's arm with the back of his hand. "Come on." He walked along the back of the dim church and opened a door to a steep staircase. At the top, Adam found himself on a hidden balcony, populated by 2 pews and a pipe organ. A statue of Mary, probably Mary, held its hands out to him, but that was because she didn't know him. Then again, she entreated Ronan too, and she probably did know him. A few small candles burned at her feet. "The choir sits up here," Ronan said, sitting at the organ. Without warning, he played a terrifically loud and shockingly sonorous fragment. "Ronan," hissed Adam. He looked at Mary, but she didn't seem bothered. "I told you no one's here." When Ronan saw that Adam still did not believe, he explained, "It's confession day up in Woodville, and they share our priest. This is when Matthew used to have his organ lessons because no one would be around to care how bad he sucked." Adam finally sat down on one of the pews.
Laying his cheek against the smooth back of it, he looked at Ronan. Strangely enough, Ronan belonged here, too, just as he had at the barns. This noisy, lush religion had created him just as much as his father's world of dreams. It seemed impossible for all of Ronan to exist in one person. Adam was beginning to realize that he hadn't known Ronan at all. Or rather, he had known part of him and assumed it was all of him. The scent of Cabe's water, all trees after rain, drifted past Adam, and he realized that while he'd been looking at Ronan, Ronan had been looking at him. "So, Green Mantle," he said, and Ronan looked away. "Fucker. Yeah. I looked up all the public stuff that first night. It would have been easy enough for Ronan to do it himself, but perhaps he had known that Adam would like the mind-occupying puzzle of it. Double PhD, home in Boston, 3 speeding tickets in the last 18 months, blah, blah, blah. What about the spider and web stuff?" "Doesn't matter," Adam replied. It had taken him only a little bit of time to get the readily available version of Colin Greenmantle's life story, and only a little bit more time to realize that it wasn't really the life story he needed. He didn't need to undo the web, probably couldn't undo the web. He needed to spin a new web. "Of course it matters. It's all that matters." "No, Ronan, look. Come here." Adam began to write in the dust on the pew beside him. Ronan joined him, crouching to read it. "What's that?" "The things we would put into place," Adam said. He'd worked it all out in his head. Though it would have been easier to write it down, he'd thought better of it. Better to have no paper trail or electronic record. Only Cabe's water could hack into the record of Adam's mind. "This is all the bits of evidence you'd need to dream and how we'd need to bury them." Some of the things needed to be literally buried. The plan was tidy in conception, but not in execution. It was filthy business framing someone, and murders required bodies, or at least parts of bodies. "It looks like a lot," Adam admitted, because it did once he had written it all down in the dust. "I guess it kind of is, but it's mostly small things." Ronan finished reading Adam's plan. He had his face slightly turned away from the horror of it, just as he had turned his face away from his dream object. He said, "But this isn't what happened. This isn't what Greenmantle did." Ronan didn't have to say it. "This is a lie." Adam should have known this would be a problem for him. He struggled to explain. "I know it's not, but it's too hard to frame him for having your father killed. It's too subtle, and it has too many pieces I don't know. He could refute one of our pieces with a real piece, or something real, like the real timeline of what he actually did, could ruin something we'd come up with. But if I invent the crime, I can control all the pieces." Ronan just stared at him. "Look, and it has to be something really horrible, something he wouldn't want to go to prison for," Adam said. Now he was feeling a little dirty. He couldn't tell if Ronan's visible distaste was just from the nature of the crime Adam had suggested or from Adam being able to contemplate such a crime at all. But he persisted because it was too late to back out now. "We want him too threatened to even think about opening his mouth or countering. If he was even accused of this, he'd be ruined, and he'll know that. And if he did get nailed for it, people who commit crimes against children are treated badly in jail, and he'll know that too." Adam could see the two sides of Ronan warring, could see, unbelievably, that the lie was going to lose. "Only once," Adam said quickly, "it's just this once. I could redo it to actually be about your father, but it wouldn't be as bulletproof, and then you'd have to deal with court cases. So would Matthew." He felt bad about that last part, even though it was true, because he knew it would sway Ronan, and it did. "Okay," Ronan said unhappily. He looked at the plan written in the dust and his eyebrows furrowed. "Gansey would hate this." Because it was the worst kind of filth. Kings were not meant to drag their hems in this. "That's why we're not going to tell him." He expected Ronan to balk on this point too, but he just nodded. Two things they agreed on: protecting Gansey's crumbling feelings and lying by omission. "Do you think you can do it?" Adam asked. "It's a lot of specifics." "It should have been impossible," No one should have been able to dream any of these things, much less all of them. But Adam had seen what Ronan could do. He'd read the Dreamt Will, and ridden in the Dreamt Camaro, and been terrified by the Dreamt Night Terror. It was possible that there were two gods in this church. Ronan crouched by the pew again, studying the list, his fingers running idly over his stubble as he thought. When he wasn't trying to look like an asshole, his face looked very different, and for a tilting moment, Adam felt the startling inequality of their relationship. Ronan knew Adam, but Adam wasn't sure he knew Ronan after all. "I'll do it now," Ronan said finally. "Now?" Adam asked incredulously. "Here? Now?" Ronan flashed a cocky grin, pleased to have gotten a reaction. "No time like the present, Parrish. Now. Everything but the phone. I have to see what kind he has before I can dream that." Adam glanced around the still church. It still felt so inhabited. Even though he intellectually believed Ronan that the church would stay empty, in his heart he felt crowded by possibilities. But Ronan's face held a challenge, and Adam wasn't going to back down. He said, "I know what kind of phone he has." "Telling me a model isn't good enough. I need to see it," replied Ronan. Adam hesitated and then asked, "What if I asked Caveswater to show you his phone in the dream? I know what kind it is." He waited for Ronan to falter or wonder over Adam's strangeness, but Ronan just straightened and rubbed his hands together. "Yeah, good, good. Look, maybe you should go, though, to the apartment, and I'll meet you after I'm done." "Why?" Ronan said. "Not everything in my head is a great thing, Parrish, believe it or not. I told you. And when I'm bringing something back from a dream, sometimes I can't bring back only one thing."
"I'll risk it.
At least give me some room." Adam retreated to sit beside Mary as Ronan stretched out on the pew, rubbing out the dingy plan with the legs of his jeans. Something about his stillness on the pew and the funereal quality of the light reminded Adam of the effigy of Glendower they'd seen at the tomb, a king sleeping. Adam couldn't imagine, though, the strange wild kingdom that Ronan might rule.
"Stop watching me," Ronan said, though his eyes were closed.
"Whatever. I'm going to ask Caveswater for the phone."
"See you on the other side."
As Ronan fidgeted, Adam flicked his eyes over to the candles at Mary's feet. It was harder to look into a flame than a pool of black water, but it served the same purpose. As his vision whited out, he felt his mind loosen and detached from his body, and just before he fell out of himself, he asked Caveswater to give Ronan the phone. Asking was not quite the right word. Showing was better, because he showed Caveswater what he needed, the image of the phone presenting itself to Ronan. Time was impossible to judge when he scried. Nearby? What was nearby? He heard a sharp sound, like a caw, and he suddenly realized that he wasn't sure if he'd been staring into the light for a minute, or an hour, or a day. His own body felt like the flame, flickering and fragile. He was getting in too deep. Time to go back. He waded back, retreating into his bones. He felt the moment his mind clung to his body once more. His eyes flickered open. Ronan was convulsing in front of him. Adam jerked his legs in toward his body, out of reach of the disaster just in front of him. Ronan's arms were streaked with blood, and his hands were pinpricked with visceral, juicy wounds. His jeans were soaked black. The church carpet glistened with it. But the horror was his spine, bent back on itself. It was his hand pressed to his throat. It was his breath. A gasp, a choked-off word. It was his fingers shaking as he held them to his mouth. It was his eyes, open too wide, too bright, cast up to the ceiling, seeing only pain. Adam didn't want to move. He couldn't move. He couldn't do this. This wasn't happening. But it was, and he could. He scrambled forward. Ronan! Oh, God! Because now that he was closer, he could see what a ruin Ronan's body was. Beyond repair. He was dying. "I did this. This was my idea. He didn't even really want to.
Are you happy now? Ronan asked. Is this what you wanted?
Adam started violently. The voice had come from somewhere else. He looked up and found Ronan sitting cross-legged on the pew above them, his expression watchful. One of this Ronan's hands was bloody too, but it was clearly not his own blood. Something dark flickered across his face as he cast his eyes down to his dying double. The other Ronan whimpered. It was a hideous sound. What's happening? Adam asked. He felt lightheaded. He was awake. He was dreaming.
You said you wanted to stay and watch, Ronan snarled from the bench. Enjoy the show.
Adam understood now. The real Ronan had not moved. He'd woken exactly where he had fallen asleep. This dying Ronan was a copy.
Why would you dream this? Demanded Adam.
He wanted his brain to believe that this agonized Ronan wasn't real, but the duplication was too perfect. He saw at once a Ronan Lynch violently dying and a Ronan Lynch watching with cool remove. Both were true, though both should have been impossible.
I tried for too much at once, Ronan said from the pew. His words were short, clipped. He was trying not to look like he cared about watching himself die. Maybe he didn't. Maybe this happened all the time.
What a fool Adam was to think he knew anything about Ronan Lynch.
It wasn't the sort of thing, the sort of things I normally dream about. And everything got agitated. The night horrors came. Then the wasps. I could tell I would bring them back with me. That I'd wake up like that. So I dreamt another me for them to have, and then I woke up, and here I am. And here I am again. What a cool trick. What a damn cool trick.
The other Ronan was dead. Adam felt the same way he had when he'd seen the dream world. Reality was twisting in on itself. Here was Ronan dead and ungrievable, because there was Ronan alive and unblinking.
Here, said Ronan, here's your shit, the lies you wanted.
He thrust a bulging, oversized manila envelope at Adam, full, presumably, of the evidence to frame Greenmantle. It took Adam too long to realize that Ronan wanted him to take it, and then a second longer to shift his mind to the mechanics of taking it. Adam told his hand to reach out, and reluctantly it did.
Get it together, Adam.
There was blood on the envelope, and now on Adam's hand. He asked, did you get everything?
It's all there.
Even the...
It's all there.
What an impossible and miraculous and hideous thing this was. An ugly plan hatched by an ugly boy now dreamt into ugly life. From dream to reality. How appropriate it was that Ronan, left to his own devices, manifested beautiful cars and beautiful birds and tender-hearted brothers, while Adam, when given the power, manifested a filthy string of perverse murders. Adam asked, what now? What do we do with...
Nothing, growled Ronan. You do nothing. No, you do what I asked before. Go.
What?
Ronan was quivering, not from venom like the other Ronan, but from some chained emotion.
I said I didn't want you here in case this happened, and now it has, and look at you.
Adam thought he'd taken the whole thing pretty well, considering. Gansey would have swooned by this point. He certainly couldn't see how his presence had made the situation any worse. He could see, however, that Ronan Lynch was angry because he wanted to be angry. Way to be an asshole. This wasn't my fault.
I didn't say it was your fault, Ronan said. I said, get the hell away from me.
The two boys stared at each other. Insanely, it felt like every other argument they'd ever had, even though this time there was a Ronan-shaped body curled between them covered in gore. This was just Ronan wanting to shout where someone could hear him. Adam felt it whittling away at his temper, not because he believed Ronan was angry at him, but because he was tired of Ronan thinking this was the only way to show he was upset. He said, oh, come on. What now?
Ronan said, bye. That's what.
Whatever, Adam said, heading for the stairs. Next time you can die alone. 32. Back at the apartment, Adam stood in the shower for a very long time. For once, the part of his brain that calculated how much a long, hot shower might cost was silent. He stood in the water until it had gone tepid. After he got out and dressed, it occurred to him belatedly that Ronan might have been upset by the dream itself, not by watching himself die. He had gone to sleep intending to get evidence of murder and had woken with blood on his hands. Adam knew that the night horrors only came to Ronan when he had a nightmare. Ronan must have known what would be waiting for him, but still, he'd charged in willingly when Adam had asked him. Probably Adam should see if he was all right. Surely he would still be there. But Adam stayed where he was, thinking about the other Ronan, the dead one. The strangest part was that the moment had been Adam's vision from the tree in Caveswater, but turned inside out. Not Gansey dying, but Ronan. So had that vision been wrong? Had he changed his future already? Or was there more to come? There was a knock on the apartment door. Probably Ronan, although it would be uncommonly unlike him to be the first to admit wrongdoing. The knock came again, more insistent. Adam checked to make sure his hands were no longer bloody, and then he opened the door. It was his father. He opened the door. It was his father. He opened the door. It was his father. "Aren't you going to ask me to come in?" his father was saying. Adam's body wasn't his, and so, with a little wonder, he watched himself step back to allow Robert Parrish to enter his apartment. How narrow-shouldered he was beside this other man. It was hard to see where he'd come from without a close look at their faces. Then one could see how Robert Parrish wore Adam's thin, fine lips. Then it wasn't hard to see the same fair hair, spun from dust, and the wrinkle between the eyebrows formed by wariness. It was actually not a difficult thing at all to see that one had sired the other. Adam couldn't remember what he had been thinking about before he opened the door. "So this is where you're keeping yourself," said Robert Parrish. He peered at the thrift store shelf, the makeshift nightstand, the mattress on the floor. Adam was a thing standing out of the way. "It seems like you and I have a date together soon," added his father. He stopped to stand directly in front of Adam. "You gonna look in my face when I talk to you, or are you gonna keep looking at that shelf?" Adam was going to keep looking at that shelf. "Okay, then. Look, I know we had some words, but I think you might as well call this thing off. Your mother's real upset, and it's going to look pretty ridiculous on the day of it." Adam was pretty sure that his father was not allowed to be here. He didn't remember everything that had happened after he'd pressed charges, but he did think it had involved a temporary restraining order. At the time, he thought he remembered finding it comforting, a memory that seemed foolish now. His father had beaten him for years before being caught, and a punch was a bigger act than a trespass. He could call the police afterward, of course, and report his father's violation. He wasn't certain if they would penalize his father, but the adult side of Adam thought that it seemed like a good thing to get on the record. All of that, though, would come after these minutes that he still had to live through. He did not want to get hit. It was a strange realization. It wasn't that Adam had ever gotten used to being struck. Pain was a wondrous thing that way. It always worked. But back when he'd lived at home, he'd gotten used to the idea of that sort of intimate violence. Now, though, enough days had passed that he had stopped expecting it, which made the sudden possibility of it somehow more intolerable. He did not want to get hit. He would do what he needed to do to not get hit. Anticipation trembled in his hands.
"Caveswater is not the boss of you,"
Persephone's voice said.
"Adam, I'm being real decent here, but you're trying my patience sorely," his father told him. "At least pretend like you heard what I said."
"I heard," Adam replied.
"Sass. Nice."
"Just because it tantrums doesn't mean it's more right than you."
"To the shelf," Adam said. "I think you should go." He felt cowardly and boneless.
So that's how it's going to be?
That was how it was going to be.
You should know, then, that you're going to look like a fool in that courtroom, Adam, Robert Parrish said. People know me, and they know what kind of man I am. You and I both know this is just a pathetic cry for attention, and everyone else will, too. It's too easy to look at you and see what kind of shit you become. Don't think I don't know where this comes from. You prancing around with those entitled bitch boys.
Part of Adam was still there with his father, but most of him was retreating. The better part of him. That Adam, the magician, was no longer in his apartment. That Adam walked through trees, running his hand along the moss-covered stones.
Court's gonna see right through that. And you know what you're going to be then? In the papers as that kid who wanted to put his hard-working daddy in jail.
The leaves rustled, close and protective, pressing up against his ears, curled in his fists. They didn't mean to frighten. They only ever tried to speak his language and get his attention. It was not fearsome Cabeswater's fault that Adam had already been a fearful boy when he'd made the bargain.
You think they're really going to look at you and see an abused kid? Do you even know what abuse is? That judge will have heard enough stories to know a whopper. He's not going to blink an eye.
The branches leaned toward Adam, curling around him protectively, a thicket with thorns pointed outward. It had tried before to cling to his mind, but now it knew to surround his body. He'd asked to be separate, and Cabeswater had listened. I know you are not the same as him, Adam said, but in my head everything is always so tangled. I am such a damaged thing.
So we're back where we started, you and me, when I came here. You can call off that hearing quick as you please, and this all goes away.
The rain splattered down through the leaves, turning them upside down, trickling onto Adam.
And look at you, and I've just been talking to you. Practicing for your day in court? At least pretend like I haven't been talking to a wall. What the hell?
The braying note in his father's voice brought Adam rushing back to himself. One hand was poised in the air as if he had meant to touch Adam, or had already and was withdrawing. In the meat of his palm, a small thorn protruded. A thread of blood trembled from the wound, bright as a miracle. Plucking the thorn free, his father regarded Adam, this thing he had made. He was silent for a long moment, and then something registered in his face. It wasn't quite fear, but it was uncertainty. His son was before him, and he did not know him. I am unknowable. Robert Parrish began to speak, but then he didn't. Now he had seen something in Adam's face or eyes, or felt something in that thorn that pricked him, or maybe like Adam, he could now smell the scent of a damp forest floor in the apartment. You going to be a fool in that courtroom? His father said finally. Are you going to say anything? Adam was not going to say anything. His father slammed the door behind him as he left. Adam stood there for a long moment. He wiped the heel of his hand over his right eye and cheek, then dried it on his slacks. He climbed back into his bed and closed his eyes, hands balled to his chest, scented with mist and with moss. When he closed his eyes, Cabeswater was still waiting for him.
33.
The thing that amazes me, Greenmantle mused aloud, is that there are some people who actually do this as a form of leisure. People who trade vacation days for this experience. It dazzles, really. I have absolutely no idea where we are. I'm assuming you'd have said something if we were lost and, or we're going to die down here.
The Greenmantles were in a cave. Wife, husband, dog, an American cave family. Piper had discovered that Otho, when left alone, ate through the bathroom doors of rental homes, so he now minced ahead of her. The cave was dark and armpit-scented. Greenmantle had done a perfunctory amount of research on caving before setting out this afternoon. He discovered that caves were supposed to be vessels of natural, untouched beauty. It turned out they were just holes in the ground. He felt caves had been extremely oversold.
We're not going to die down here, Piper said. I have book club on Tuesday.
Book club? You've only been here 2 weeks and you're in a book club.
What else am I supposed to do while you're out finding yourself? Just hang around the house, getting fat, I suppose? Don't say talk to your little friends on the phone, because I'll put this pickaxe through your right eye.
What's the book?
Piper pointed the flashlight at the ceiling and then the damp floor. Both the flashlight beam and Piper's lip curled in disgust.
I don't remember the title. Something about citrus.
It's a literary memoir of a young woman coming of age on an orange plantation, set against a backdrop of war and subversive class struggle with possible religious undertones or something like that. Don't say I'd rather die.
I didn't say anything, Greenmantle replied, although he had indeed been considering I'd rather die as a candidate to further the conversation. He preferred spy thrillers that involved dashing men who were slightly over 30 darting in and out of high-technology shadows while driving fast cars and making important phone calls. He held up the EMF reader in his hand to see if he could vary the degree of flashing going on across its face. He could not.
Otho had stopped to relieve himself. Piper flicked out a plastic baggie.
This is pointless. Did you just put that shit in your bag?
I saw a spot on ABC about how ecotourism is denuding caves, she informed him. That face, the one you're wearing now, is part of the problem. You are part of the problem.
Holes in the ground were, in Greenmantle's opinion, the very best place to throw dog crap into. He swiped the EMF reader across the wall with one hand and a geophone with the other. He would have gotten an identical amount of insight if he'd been holding a flare and a ukulele.
What I'm going to do is hire a billion million minions to come look in caves for this woman, and if that doesn't work, I'll just eviscerate her daughter in front of the gray man instead.
Minions? I don't want a million minions tramping around down here. I want to explore my psychic connections without all that grunting going on.
Your psychic connections?
He felt her glaring at him. The skin on the back of his neck was melting.
Fine. I'll tell them to be tactful.
You know what? You should let me have two of them to help me in my life goals.
What?
I could call them and pretend to be you.
Hi, Thugman. This is Colin. Could you do me a solid?
She did a passable job of his voice, if slightly too nasal and in love with itself. She stopped short, legs apart, blonde hair billowing around her like a caving photo shoot. For a strange slipping moment, Greenmantle thought that he'd found her in the cave and was bringing her back to the light, and then he remembered the bag of dog shit and how they'd gotten here. He thought that this cave was probably full of carbon monoxide. He was probably dying.
Piper asked, "Did you hear that?"
"The sound of you mocking me?"
She didn't reply. She was frowning down the tunnel, her chin lifted, her eyebrows pushed together as if she were listening. He thought about someone sleeping. He thought about waking them up.
"The sound of my love," he tried. She still didn't reply. She was still listening. "The sound of you creeping me the hell out."
But really, he was creeping himself out. Finally, she turned back to him. She did not look as if she had heard the sound of his love. She said,
"I definitely need two of your minions. Let's get back to a cell phone signal."
He was very happy to oblige. He never wanted to see a cave again.
34.
Gansey might have found Gwynplaine, but Blue had to live with her. All of the women of 300 Fox Way had to, actually. It was like living with a natural disaster, or a feral child, or a feral natural child disaster. For starters, she didn't sleep. She shouted at Calla that she had had enough sleep for 1,000 lifetimes and that she intended to spend the rest of this one awake and then proceeded to do just that. At small hours of the morning, Blue would wake and hear her clogging around in the attic above her room. Then there was her manner of dress.
Her supernatural awareness inside the tomb had given her just enough exposure to the changing outside world to not be shocked by the existence of cars or befuddled by the English language, but not enough to award her any social customs. So she wore what she wanted to wear. Blue could at least respect the motivation, if not the outcome, which was always a dress, sometimes two or three on top of each other, sometimes backward. This often involved stealing clothing from other people's closets. Blue was spared only because she was so much shorter. There were problems with mealtimes, too. For Gwynthian, every time was mealtime. She seemed to have neither sense of fullness nor taste, and would often combine foods and manners that struck Blue as problematic. She didn't believe in telling people how to live their lives. Well, maybe a little, but it was hard to stand by and watch Gwynthian spread peanut butter on a cold hot dog. And there was the crazy part. 40% of what came out of her mouth came out in song, and the rest was a varied mixture of chanting, screaming, mocking, and creepy whisper. She climbed on the roof, she talked to the tree in the backyard, and she stood on furniture. She often put things in her hair for later retrieval and then seemed to forget they were there. In very short order, her enormous tangle of hair became a vertical repository for pencils, leaves, tissues, and matches. "We could cut it," Orla suggested at one point. Persephone said, "I do not think that is a decision one human can make for another human." Orla asked, "Even if that other human looks like a hobo?" It was a point on which Blue and Orla agreed. The worst part of it was that Gansey had offered to take her away, kept offering to take her away, and Persephone insisted Gwynthian stay with them.
"It takes longer than a weekend to undo centuries of damage," Persephone said.
"Centuries of damage are being incurred in just a weekend," Calla replied.
"She's a very gifted psychic," Persephone said mildly. "Eventually she will earn her keep."
"And pay for my therapy," Blue added.
"Good one," Orla said.
To reward Blue for her excellent comeback, she painted Blue's fingernails to match the pig, a polished color, she informed Blue, that was called belligerent candy. Gansey kept trying to talk with Gwynplaine, but she was always sassily deferential when he came to the house. On top of that, Gansey had some sort of school commitment that he was cagey about. Ronan and Adam kept vanishing places together, and Noah couldn't or wouldn't come into 300 Foxway. Blue was feeling a little as if she had been locked into a madhouse.
"Mom, it's time for you to come home."
The gray man came over midweek, much to her gratitude. "It's me," he called down the hallway as he stepped inside. Blue could see him from her homework post at the kitchen table. He was tidy and dangerous-looking in a gray shirt and slacks. He looked more optimistic than the last time she had seen him. Gwynthian, who was examining the roaring vacuum cleaner but not vacuuming with it, spotted him too.
"Hello, handsome sword. Have you killed anyone today?"
"One sword knows another," he told her mildly, placing his car keys in his pocket. "Have you killed anyone?" She was so delighted that she turned off the vacuum cleaner so that her insane smile could be the loudest thing in the hall. "Mr. Gray, leave her alone and come get a cup of tea," Blue called from the kitchen table. "You'll make her start singing again." The gray man glanced over his shoulder at Gwynthian as he came into the kitchen and did as Blue instructed, taking a few minutes to find a tea more likely to provoke sanguinity than loose stools. "I have been employed by your friends, Mr. Parrish and Mr. Lynch," he said as he sat down opposite Blue.
"So this is where those two were going."
He tapped one of her algebra problems until she dragged it back to her and reworked it correctly. "They have a plan for Greenmantle, and it seems quite promising."
"What is it?"
"I would rather not tell you, as it is better the fewer people know it. Also, it is not polite table conversation," Mr. Gray said. "I have a question for you. Your cursed cave. Do you think it is the sort of place you could hide a body, or at least part of one?" Blue narrowed her eyes.
"There was lots of room in that cave for lots of things. Whose body? Which part?"
Gwynthian instantly manifested in the kitchen, dragging the vacuum cleaner behind her like a reluctantly walked dog.
"What about the curse, Lily?"
"I thought you were the curse," Blue replied.
"Probably,"
Gwynthian said carelessly.
What else is there but I? I'm known to Welshmen free, lovely Gwen, from Gower to Anglesey, lovely Gwen, oh Gwen the dead.
Blue said, I told you she would start singing. But the gray man just raised his eyebrows. Weapons and poetry go hand in hand. Gwynplaine drew herself up.
What a cunning weapon you are. A poet is how I ended up in that cave.
Is it a good story? The gray man asked.
Oh, it is the finest.
Blue watched the exchange with a bit of awe. Somewhere there was a lesson in this. The gray man took a sip of his tea. You should sing it for us. And unbelievably, she did. She sang a furious little song about Glendower's poet, Iolo Gok, and how he whispered war in her father's ear. She whispered this part into Blue's ear. And so, as blood soaked into the ground of Wales, Gwynplaine did her level best to stab him to death. Was he sleeping? The gray man asked with professional interest. Gwynplaine laughed for about a minute. Then she said, It was a dinner. What a lovely meal he would have been. Then she spit in the gray man's tea, but it seemed to have more to do with Iolo Gok than Mr. Gray. He sighed and pushed the cup away. So they sentenced you to that cave.
It was that or hanging, and I chose hanging, so they gave me the false grave instead.
Blue squinted at Gwynplaine, trying to imagine her as she had been 6 centuries before. A young woman, Orla's age, the daughter of a nobleman. A witch in an age when witches were not always the best thing to be, surrounded by war and doing her best to stop it. Blue wondered if she would have the courage to stab someone if she thought it would save lives. Gwynplaine dragged the vacuum cleaner back into the hall without any sort of goodbye. Gwynplaine and vacuum exit stage right, Blue said. The gray man pushed his tea even farther away. Do you think you might have time to show me this cave you pulled her from just so I know where it is as an option? The idea of leaving the house was incredibly appealing. It wouldn't be a bad thing to see Jessie again either. And although she was annoyed that Adam and Ronan hadn't trusted her with whatever their Green Mantle plan was, she wanted to be helpful anyway. Possibly. Will you feed me? I won't even spit in it. Blue warned Calla that she was leaving the house with a hitman, and then Mr. Gray took her to the downtown drugstore for a tuna fish sandwich, best tuna fish in town, before driving out of Henrietta. The car zoomed and darted through the darkness in a way that seemed slightly out of the gray man's control. This car is really terrible, Blue said. This was allowed, as the car was not really Mr. Gray's. It was a hand-me-down white Mitsubishi of the sort that young men with big dreams and egos normally drove. It sported a custom license plate that read, Thief. It grows on you, Mr. Gray said. He paused, like a cancer. Ba-dum-pa. Both Blue and Mr. Gray enjoyed a laugh and then were briefly silent as they realized it had been too long since they had been in the company of someone with their precise sense of humor, i.e., Maura Sargent. In the background, the Kinks played gently, the sound of Mr. Gray's soul. I keep waiting for things to go back to normal, Blue admitted, but I know now that that's not going to happen, even when Mom comes back. She meant if, but she said when. I wouldn't have pegged you for a fan of normal, the gray man said. He slowed slightly as the headlights illuminated the eyes of 3 deer standing by the side of the road. It was warming to be so known. She said, I'm not really, but I was used to it, I guess. It's boring, but at least it's not scary. Do you ever get scared? Or are you too badass for that? He looked amused, but also like a badass, sitting quietly and efficiently behind the wheel of the car. In my experience, the gray man said, the badasses are the most scared. I just avoid being inappropriately frightened. Blue thought this seemed like a reasonable goal. After a pause, she said, You know, I like you. He glanced over at her. I do, too. Like me or like you? The grammar was unspecific. The two of them enjoyed another laugh in the presence of someone else with their precise sense of humor. Oh, here it is, Blue said. Don't pass it. The Ditley farm was mostly dark as they pulled down the driveway, with only the kitchen window lit up.
For a moment, Blue thought perhaps Jesse had left to win back his wife and son and dog, but then she saw his big silhouette pull aside the curtain to observe their headlights pulling up to the house. He came to the door at once. "Howdy," Blue said. "I came to impose on you and maybe show Mr. Gray your cave, if that's okay." He let them in.
"Your breath smells like tuna fish."
"Should I have brought you some?" she asked.
"I only eat SpaghettiOs."
He shook hands with the Gray man, who introduced himself as Mr. Gray. Then Jesse leaned, and Blue stood on tiptoes, and they hugged, because that seemed right.
"I just took some Girl Scout cookies out of the freezer."
"Oh, that's okay," Blue said. "As you smelled, we just ate." "I'll take one," the Gray man interjected, "if they're thin mints." Jesse fetched them.
"Nothing for you, ain't,"
she said. "How about a glass of water and an exciting update about how great your life is now that we've taken the crazy person out of your cave?"
"Life is great," Jesse admitted. "But the cave, are you wearing boots because it is muddy?"
Blue and Mr. Gray assured him they were fine with their current footwear. Retrieving a flashlight for Blue and a floodlight and a shotgun for himself, Jesse led the three of them across the dark field to the building that housed the cave. As they grew closer, Blue thought she smelled something familiar. It was not the earthy scent of the wet field or the smoky scent of the fall night. It was metallic and close, damp and stagnant. It was the smell, Blue realized, of the Cave of Ravens.
"Watch your step."
"What am I watching for?" Mr. Gray asked.
"That is the right question."
Jesse minced as best a Ditley could mince to the door. He handed the floodlight to Blue as he unlocked the padlock.
"Stand back."
She stood back.
"Backer than that."
She stood back farther. The Gray man stepped in front of her, only enough to block an assault, not her view. Jesse Ditley kicked in the door. It was a slow motion kick because his leg was so long. There was a considerable lag between when he began to swing his leg and when his foot actually hit the door. Blue wondered what that was called. A leg roundhouse or something. The door opened.
"Yup,"
said Jesse as something shot toward him. It was a terrible something. Blue was a fairly open-minded human, she thought, willing to accept that there was a good bit of the world that was outside her understanding and knowledge. She knew academically that just because something looked scary didn't mean that it wanted to hurt you. But this something wanted to hurt them. It wasn't even malevolence. It was that sometimes something was on your side and sometimes it was not, and this was not. Whatever humans were, this was against. The sensation of being undone buffeted them, and then something charged through the doorway. The Gray man took an enormous black handgun from his jacket and shot the thing three times in each of its heads. It fell to the ground. There was not much in the way of heads left.
"That seemed excessive,"
Jesse said. "Yes," agreed the Gray man. Blue was glad that it was dead and then felt bad that she felt glad that it was dead. It was easier to be generous about it now that it wasn't trying to unwind the core of her existence. Jesse closed the door and locked it again.
"That has been my week."
She looked at the strange, jointless body, vaguely wormish, glittering rainbow scales in the beam of her flashlight. She couldn't decide if it was ugly or beautiful or just unlike anything she had seen before. Have there been a lot of them?
"Enough."
"Have you seen any of these before?" Mr. Gray asked.
"Not till now. Don't always look this way, either. Some of them don't want to kill you. Some of them are just old things. They do get in the house, though."
"Why are they coming out?" Blue asked.
"Told you the cave was cursed."
"But we took her out."
"Reckon she was the one keeping them down. Cave loves a sacrifice."
They all regarded the body for several long minutes. Mr. Gray said, "Shall we dispose of it?"
"Nah, crows will eat what's left."
Blue said, "This seems pretty bad." She wanted to offer to help, but what could they do? Put Gwynplyn back? The Gray man tucked his gun away. He looked displeased by this entire turn of events. Blue wondered if he was thinking about hiding body parts in a cave that already seemed to be full of bodies, and then she wondered if he was thinking about Mora in a cave with these creatures, and as soon as she thought about it herself, her expression mirrored the Gray man's.
"There, there, little aunt,"
Jesse said.
I reckon she guarded the cave for her time. Now it's my turn.
35.
That night, Gwynplaine's laugh announced her presence at the doorway to Blue's bedroom. It was poor timing. Blue was in a terrible mood because it was time for Maura to come back, or for her to go find Maura, or something. She would go to the Cave of Ravens herself. She would battle monsters in Ditley's cave and charge to the middle of the earth looking for her. She made plans and broke them and rewrote them, a new one every second. Gwynplaine laughed again, meaningfully. It was her version of clearing her throat. With a sigh, Blue rolled over. She found the other woman treasuring a spoon of something that looked terribly like it might be mayonnaise.
Are you running away, little Blue Lily?
Not yet, Blue replied, narrowing her eyes at Gwynplaine to see if there was a deeper meaning. In the background, she heard Calla and Persephone fighting in Persephone's room. Well, really, Calla was fighting and Persephone was saying nothing. She continued,
Look, there's no nice way to ask this, so I'm going to put it out there. Do you think you might grow out of the crazy anytime soon? Because I have a lot of questions about my father, and my mother's missing, and trying to do crime scene via sing-along is starting to stress me out.
You begin to sound like your princeling, little Lily, Gwynplaine said, and I'm not sure that's your place. Which is to say, carry on. I'm all for ranks of usurping women.
Blue let this pass. Gwynplaine had already proven herself extremely gifted at finding each person's one weakness and then leaning on it casually. I just want my mother back, and please stop calling me that. My name's Blue.
Lily,
Gwynplaine added.
Please.
Lily.
Stop.
Blue.
Gwynplaine finished with some triumph. She finished whatever was left on the spoon. Possibly it was hair conditioner.
Come to my room, and I will show you how we are the same, you and I, and I and you.
With a sigh, Blue rolled out of her bed and followed Gwynplaine up to the dim attic. Even now, after the sun had gone down, it was several degrees warmer than the house, which made it feel small and close like a jacket. Blue had cleaned up nearly all of the evidence Neve had left behind, and Persephone and Calla had picked over the rest. The only sizable remains were two large mirrors that stood facing each other in the dormer. Gwynplaine led Blue directly to them, careful not to stand between them. She pet Blue's hair with both hands like she was smoothing a wig, and then used her hands to turn Blue's head to the mirror on the left.
That is I, she said.
She turned Blue's head to the mirror on the right.
That is Vul.
Explain.
I have been a sword, and I have been a thunderclap, and I have been a burned-out comet, and I have been a word, and I have been a mirror.
Blue waited until the song was done.
So you're saying you're a mirror?
Of the deepest blue,
Gwynplaine whispered in Blue's ear. She leapt back so that she could trace the shape of Blue in the air with her fingers.
Blue, 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 all around, and me, it's what we do.
Oh, our auras? Okay, sure. But Persephone says that you're psychic and I am definitely not.
Very bored, Gwynplaine spread her arms out dramatically, both hands once again pointed at the mirrors.
Mirrors! I am telling you, that is what we do!
Something prickled in Blue uncomfortably. She eyed the mirrors. Neve had used them for divination, Calla said. She'd stood between them and seen endless possibilities for herself stretched out on either side in either mirror. Maura was always shuffling the page of cups out of her tarot deck and showing it to Blue.
Look, it's you. Look at all the potential she holds.
Yes, Gwynplaine said shrill. You're getting it. Do they use you, Blue Lily? Do they ask you to hold their hands so they can better see their future? Do you make them see the dead? Do you get sent from the room when things get too loud for them?
Blue nodded dumbly.
Mirrors, Gwynplaine cooed. That is what we are.
When you hold a candle in front of a glass, doesn't it make the room twice as bright?
So do we, blue lily, lily blue.
She leapt onto her mattress. How useful! A wonderful addition to the stables, like the steed of Gwythyr and Gwarfyr and Cionan and Lu.
She broke from her song to shake her head and say in a more normal voice,
No, not of Lu, but the others.
Lu couldn't quite believe that she had finally met someone who was like her. She hadn't known it was possible.
What is Blue Lily, then? Where is that name from?
Gwynplaine charged the mirror, stopping just short of going between them. She flung herself around to stand an inch in front of Blue.
Witches, my little floral cushion. That's what we are.
A delicious and wicked thrill went through Blue at the word. It was not that she had aspirations of being a witch. It was that she had been a nameless accessory for so long that the idea of having a title or being anything was a delicious one, but misguided.
Maybe you, Blue said, but the best I can do is not help people, sometimes.
She thought about how she had pulled the plug on Noah in Monmouth but had been unable to at Jesse Diddley's. That, she realized, had been Gwynplaine.
People!
Gwynplaine laughed gloriously.
People! Men!
What makes you think you are a friend to men?
It could be argued, Blue thought, that Blue was only a friend to men, but she didn't feel it was useful to bring it up.
Whoever wants to talk to people,
Gwynplaine gestured grandly to the two mirrors.
Go! Stand in there! Stand!
Calla had previously made it quite clear that she didn't want to stand between Neve's two mirrors, and she'd also implied that doing so might have had something to do with how Neve had disappeared. Blue did not want to stand between them. Gwynplaine shoved. Blue hurtled toward them, arms wheeling. She could see the light flashing off their surfaces. She teetered. She stopped short.
Okay, I, she said.
Gwynplaine shoved her again. Blue only stepped back once, but that was enough to put her squarely between the two mirrors. She waited to be vaporized. She waited for monsters to appear. Neither thing happened. Instead, she peered slowly to her left, and then to her right, and then she looked at her hands. They were still visible, which was notable because her reflection was in neither mirror. The mirrors merely reflected each other again and again. There was something a little dark and troubling about the images inside them, but nothing more. Where am I? Blue asked Gwynplaine.
Gwynplaine laughed and sprang about, clapping gleefully. Grieve not for your stupidity. Mirror magic is nothing to mirrors.
Blue took the opportunity to step out quickly back into the middle of the room.
I don't understand.
Nor I, said Gwynplaine carelessly, and I starve from this idle talk.
The woman started down the attic stairs.
Wait, called Blue. Will you tell me about my father?
No,
Gwynplaine replied. I will get mayonnaise.
36. The very first supernatural artifact Greenmantle had acquired had been a haunted doll. He'd bought it on eBay for $500. The price included 2-day shipping. The auction listing had promised that the doll had spent the last 2 weeks in the seller's basement growling and rolling its eyes into its head. Sometimes, the listing noted, a scorpion would crawl out of the doll's ears. The listing warned that this was not a child's toy and indeed was only being offered to augment satanic or left-path rituals. Greenmantle had purchased it with equal parts skepticism and hope. To his annoyance, but not surprise, the doll was unremarkable upon arrival. It did not growl. Its eyes closed and opened only when the doll was tipped. There was no sign of any insect life. Piper, his girlfriend at the time, and he had spent the evening eating takeout sushi and throwing edamame beans at the doll in an attempt to provoke some demonic activity. Afterward, Piper said, "If we had a puppy, it could pick up those beans for us." Greenmantle had replied, "And then we could sacrifice it and use its blood to activate the doll." "Will you marry me?" she asked. He thought about it. "I love myself the most, though. Are you okay always coming in second?" "Samesies," she replied. Then she cut herself and smeared her blood on the doll's forehead, a level of personal involvement that Greenmantle had yet to achieve. The doll still never growled or bit anyone, but that night Greenmantle put it in a box in the spare bedroom, and in the morning it was lying on its face by the front door. He felt the appropriate level of thrill and fear and delight. "Lame," Piper said, stepping over it on her way to her ladies' fencing class or her naked baking club. "Find me something better." And he had. Or rather, he had hired people to find something better. Now, years later, he had loads of supernatural artifacts, nearly all of them more interesting than the occasionally moving doll. He still preferred his artifacts to be mildly atmospheric. Piper liked hers dark. Something was happening to her here in Henrietta, and it wasn't just her yoga class. He shouldn't have brought her. Greenmantle stepped into the rental house. "Piper," he called. There was no response. He paused in the kitchen to get himself a bite of cheese and a grape. "Piper, if you are being held up by Mr. Gray, bark once." She was not being held up by anything except the mirror. She was in the hall bathroom staring at herself, and she didn't answer when he called her name. This wasn't particularly unusual, as Piper was easily entranced by her own reflection. He returned to the kitchen to get himself a glass of wine. Piper had used all the wine glasses and not washed them, so he poured a nasty little Pugnatello into an Aglimby Academy mug. Then he returned to the bathroom. She was still gazing intently at herself. "You're cut off," he said, pulling her away. He noticed a tarot card, the Three of Swords, sitting on the edge of the bathroom sink. "It's time to stare at me now." She was still looking off into nowhere, so he snapped his fingers rudely in front of her for a few minutes, and then after he began to get a little creeped out, he dipped her fingers into the mug and then placed the wine-covered fingertips in her own mouth. Piper came too. "What do you want? Why are my fingers in my mouth? You are such a perversion." "I was just saying hello. Hello, honey, I'm home." "Great, you're home. I'm busy." And she slammed the bathroom door in his face. From inside the bathroom, he heard humming. It didn't sound like Piper, even though it had to be. Greenmantle thought it was probably time to finish this job and get the hell out of this place. Or maybe just get the hell out of this place. 37. Sometimes Gansey forgot how much he liked school and how good he was at it. But he couldn't forget it on mornings like this one. Fall fog rising out of the fields and lifting in front of the mountains, the pig running cool and loud, Ronan climbing out of the passenger seat and knocking knuckles on the roof with teeth flashing, dewy grass misting the black toes of his shoes, bag slung over his blazer, narrow-eyed Adam bumping fists as they met on the sidewalk, boys around them laughing and calling to one another, making space for the three of them because this had been a thing for so long. Gansey, Lynch, Parrish. Mornings like this one were made for memories. There would be nothing to ruin the crisp perfection of it if not for the presence of Greenmantle somewhere and the non-presence of Mora. If not for Gwynthlian and Blue's hands and looming caves full of promises and threats. If not for everything. It was so difficult for these two worlds to coexist. Morning crows and workmen on scaffolding called to one another over the campus as the boys walked across the school green together. The sound of hammers echoed off the buildings. They were replacing part of the roof. The scaffolding was piled with slate tiles. "Look at this," Ronan said. With a jerk of his chin, he indicated Henry Cheng, who stood with a placard on the corner of the school green. "Make a difference." after you graduate, Gansey read as they approached him. Jesus, have you been out here all night? Henry's shoes were slick with condensation, and his shoulders were shrugged up against the cold. His nose was extremely pink. His usually gloriously and enormously spiked hair, however, was still glorious and spiked. He clearly had his priorities. He'd planted another sign into a pot behind him. That one read, "Think deeply," but not about Aglenby. No way, only since six. I wanted them to think I'd been here all night. Adam raised a diffident eyebrow at the scene. Who's them? The faculty, obviously, Henry replied. Gansey removed a pen from his bag and carefully added an I to Aglenby. Is this still about the student council? They totally ignored my petition, Henry said. Fascists. I had to do something. I'm standing here until they agree to start one. Looks like you've hit on a good way to get expelled, Ronan observed. You should know. Adam narrowed his eyes. There was something different about him, or maybe there was just something different between him and Henry. Henry was a boy. Adam was a... Gansey didn't know. Adam asked, on what grounds did they ignore the petition? Henry paused to shout across the green, Ching Tu, if that coffee isn't for me, get me another. Please, thank you, please. The other Cheng distantly lifted the coffee cup in salute and shouted, Sorry, sorry, before disappearing into one of the academic buildings. No honor, muttered Henry. To Adam, he said, They said it would be too much of a drain on the administration's resources to set it up and monitor it. That seems like a reasonable reason, Adam replied, his eyes already on the class buildings. What are you even going to counsel about? The lunch menu? Ronan smirked in an unpleasant way. Ching shivered and said, You, Parrish, are part of the problem. I'll get you a coffee. Gansey eyed his watch. I've got time. Gansey, complained Ronan. I'll meet you in there. Ching said, You're a prince among men, Dick Gansey. More like a man among princes, muttered Adam. You've got 7 minutes, Gansey. Gansey left them talking to Chang and headed to the faculty room. Broadly speaking, students were not supposed to come and go freely through the faculty room, but narrowly speaking, Gansey was exempt by virtue of gross favoritism. He scuffed the damp cut grass off his shoes on the mat by the entrance and shut the door behind himself. The old floor by the door was buckled by the weight of tradition and required a hefty, familiar shove to close it. Gansey did it without thinking. Inside, the room was spare and drafty and smelled of wood smoke and bagels. It had all of the comforts of a quaint prison. Wooden benches on the walls, historic mural on the plaster, spidery chandelier overhead, gaunt spread of breakfast foods on a warped old table. Gansey stood in front of the coffee pot. He was getting that odd time-slipping feeling that the campus often gave him. The sense that he had always been standing in this old room, in this old building, or someone had, and all times and all people were the same. In that formless place, he found himself intensely grateful for Ronan and Adam waiting outside for him, for Blue and her family, for Noah and for Mallory. He was so grateful to have found all of them, finally. He thought about that pit in the Cave of Ravens. For the barest second, he thought he knew something. The answer. But he hadn't asked a question, and then it was gone anyway. And then he realized that he was hearing something, a shout, a crash, Adam's name. He didn't remember the decision to move, only his feet already running to the door. Outside, the courtyard looked like a set piece for a play. 2 dozen students dotted the green, but none of them were moving. A slow, pale cloud moved among them, slowly settling. Everyone's attention was turned toward the corner of the green where Henry had been standing. But it was Adam's name he'd heard. He saw that the topmost area of the scaffolding hung crookedly, the workmen staring down from their positions on the roof. Dust. That's what the cloud was, from whatever had fallen from the scaffolding. The slate tiles. Adam. Gansey shoved through the students. He saw Henry first, then Ronan, unharmed but powdered like Pompeii corpses.
He made eye contact with Ronan. Is it all right? And he didn't recognize Ronan's expression. There was Adam. He was standing, very still, his hands by his sides. His chin was tilted up in a wary, fragile sort of way, and his eyes narrowed at nothing. Unlike Ronan and Henry, he was dustless. Gansey saw the jerk of his chest as it rose and fell. Around him lay hundreds of shattered slate tiles. The pieces exploded out for a dozen yards, dug into the grass like missiles. But the ground around Adam was bare in a perfect circle. It was this circle, this impossible circle, that the other students stared at. Some of them were taking photos on their phones. No one was talking to Adam. It wasn't difficult to understand this. Adam didn't look like someone you could talk to just then. There was something more frightening about him than there was about the circle. Like the bare ground, there was nothing inherently unusual about his appearance, but in context, surrounded by these brick buildings, he didn't belong. Parrish, Gansey said when he got close. Adam, what happened? Adam's eyes slid over to him, but his head didn't turn. It was the stillness that made him seem so other. Behind him, he heard Ronan say, I like the way you losers thought Instagram before first aid. Fuck off.
No, don't fuck off, Henry corrected. Notify a teacher that there's some men on the roof who are about to be sued.
Scaffolding failed, Adam said in a low voice. An expression was now appearing on his face, but it too was unfamiliar. Wonder. Everything fell.
You are the luckiest man in this school, Henry said. How are you not dead, Parrish?
It's your bullshit signs, Ronan suggested, looking vastly less concerned than Gansey felt. They created a bullshit force field.
Gansey leaned, and Adam pulled him in even closer, gripping his shoulder tightly. Right into Gansey's ear, he whispered, voice tinged in disbelief.
I didn't. I just asked. I just thought.
Thought what? Gansey asked. Adam released him. His eyes were on the circle around him.
I thought that. And it happened.
The circle was absolutely perfect. Dust without, dustless within.
You marvelous creature, Gansey said, because there was nothing else to say.
Because he had just thought that these two worlds could not coexist, and yet here was Adam, both at once.
Alive because of it.
This thing they were doing. This thing. Gansey's heart was a gaping chasm of possibilities, fearful and breathless and awed. Ronan's smile was sharp. Now Gansey recognized the expression on Ronan's face. Arrogance. He had not been afraid for Adam. He had known Cave's water would save him, been certain of it. Gansey thought of how strange it was to know these two young men so well and yet to not know them at all. Both so much more difficult and so much better than when he'd first met them. Was that what life did to them all? Chiseled them into harder, truer versions of themselves?
I told you, Ronan said. Magician.
38. It was finally here. After all of the continuances, after months of waiting, it was the day of the court case. Adam got up as he would normally for school, but instead of putting on his uniform, he put on the good suit he'd bought on Gansey's advice the year before. He had not permitted Gansey to pay for any of it back then. The tie he tied on now, though, the tie was a Christmas gift from Gansey, permitted because Adam had already had a tie when Gansey bought it, so it couldn't be charity. It seemed like a silly bit of principle now, completely divorced from the point of anything. He wondered if he was going to go through each year of his life thinking about how stupid he'd been the year before. He thought about waiting until after breakfast to go get dressed, to keep from spilling anything on his suit, but that was foolish. He wouldn't be able to eat anything. His case was at 10 a.m., hours after school began, but Adam had asked permission to take the entire day off.
He knew it would be impossible to hide the reason for his absence from Gansey and Ronan if he had to leave mid-morning, and equally difficult to disguise where he'd been if he returned right after court. Part of him wished that he wasn't doing this without the others. A shocking wish in light of the fact that only a few weeks before, the very idea that Gansey might even know about the court case had troubled Adam. But now, no. He still didn't want them to remember this part of him. He only wanted them to see the new Adam. Persephone had told him that no one had to know his past if he didn't want them to. He didn't want them to. So he waited while Gansey and Ronan and Blue went off to school and had ordinary days. He sat on the edge of his mattress and worked on the plan to blackmail Greenmantle as first period happened. He stared at his biology text and thought about a dustless circle around his feet for second period. Then he drove to the courthouse. Cabe's water beckoned him, but he couldn't retreat. He had to be here for this. Every step before the courthouse was